cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com. Well, Elon Musk used to being in the driver's seat or seats, considering all that he's involved. And sometimes that even means driving some Twitter founders to a competing social network. It's kind of like, wait, what are you doing?
Now, this is really interesting. With right? Who and where they're going and the latest on the Twitter situation, here with us is Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Barinka. She joins us on camera from our LA bureau. Alex, good to have you back with us. Mastodon. What is going on with Mastodon?
And if you haven't heard of Mastodon, I'll also kind of just explain it to you. It's this kind of new-ish social network that a lot of folks who perhaps are unhappy with Twitter or who are looking for a different platform to share news or short bursts of information have been migrating to Mastodon. Now, Mastodon started as kind of a techie community. They call their kind of groups servers or instances. Initially, it was a lot of folks who were kind of deep in tech, but they've started to attract a general audience, including a couple of really notable names like Twitter co-founders Biz Stone and Ev Williams, who have now moved on the platform and said they are tinkering and trying it out.
A big complaint that I've heard about Mastodon, in full disclosure, I have not tried it. I've tried Post. I'm on Post News, but I haven't like signed in 2 weeks. This is what happens, by the way, with competing social networks, is that it's complicated. That Mastodon is like, it's kind of tough to find servers. What has your experience been based on what you've done and also like the people you've spoken to? And, you know, someone on Twitter compared it to like using Linux as an operating system.
It sort of is. You know, it is. Open source software that has these communities on it. I've gotten on it, and I'll tell you, I had the same experience. It's kind of gorpy. It's kind of tricky. I don't quite know how to use it. I only have a whopping 3 followers there versus, you know, almost 8,000 on Twitter. so there's a lot of differences. I also don't think, frankly, if I were to go to my non-tech friends and say, hey, try this thing, they wouldn't know how to sign up either. So I think that's one of the hills to climb for Mastodon, and also probably why they're excited to be kind of connected with Ev Williams, that Twitter co-founder in particular. You'll remember Ev also founded a blogging platform called Medium. And in this kind of shift over to Mastodon, Medium has set up its own instance, its own server or community, where it's going to set its own rules and encourage its authors to go over there and perhaps bring some of their users. As of recently, even after this rush of new users, Mastodon has said that they have about 2.5 million people using the platform. Compare that to the around 230 million daily active users that Twitter has. So a bit more tricky. It's not as user-friendly, and they don't have the user base. But it's really interesting that some of the moves that Twitter's making is forcing some people to even jump onto a platform that has a few more hurdles than something like Twitter might.
Alex, it makes me think, okay, if somebody can set something up that can really challenge Twitter, you could quickly see people move to it. At the same time, it made me think, you know what Twitter's power is? They've got so many people already in that universe. universe. And that's where, you know, the tricky wick is, what does Elon do with it, and to keep those people there?
Yeah, absolutely. You've seen some changes in recent days. Right now, your feed is now split. There's your following feed, which is like the old school Twitter feed of the folks that you've chosen to follow. And I also have something called my For You feed now, which for folks who watch the social media industry, that seems to be lifted from TikTok, who has an algorithmically kind of driven For You feed.
This is on Twitter?
That is interesting too. On Twitter. My Twitter currently has a For You and it has a following.
But is the For You, are the For You people interspersed within your timeline? Like, I've noticed my timeline is full of people I don't follow. Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean. It's full of people I don't follow. And I'm seeing things like tweets from 2 days ago. I'm seeing things like tweets about topics that I haven't historically kind of engaged with. So this could be a play from Twitter to try to drive engagement, to kind of lift some of the tactics that TikTok's using, that Instagram has borrowed from TikTok, of introducing you to new kind of interest areas or new people to get you more engaged on the platform. Whether or not that bears out in more engagement and more users and more advertiser interest, that will be kind of a to be determined. But it does seem like as folks like Mastodon and even, you know, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn start to take some of the typical users away from Twitter, it seems like they have to try some new things.
Why doesn't Facebook just do this? Facebook has the people, right? You know, there's so many people who are on Facebook and Instagram. Why don't they try to sort of, I don't know, become a place where for people who are disenfranchised or feel disenfranchised by Twitter?
Because they're building the metaverse. Come on, Tim. Did you not get the
metaverse? Yeah. I'm asking Alex, okay, Carol?
That might be the answer. They're building the metaverse, oh, okay. But they're also...
Carol was right.
It's part of it, but they're also investing a lot in AI that's not only applicable to photos and videos, but also to text. So it seems like whether you're interested in something, that could be a place to go. But for someone like me in the journalism industry, for folks who care about finance news, for folks who are, you know, a lot of the news sources, Twitter's kind of been the space for that. Facebook, on the other hand, has gotten into a lot of trouble for its dealings in misinformation. That's been a bit of a debate now on Twitter. But when you think about like why you go to certain platforms, Facebook seems to be, Meta with Facebook and Instagram, moving in a little bit of a different direction than where Twitter has historically been as a kind of de facto place of news, political conversation, and conversation around live events like the Super Bowl or a major sports event.
All right, Alex, so net, does Elon need to be worried about Mastodon?
I think right now the users don't give him any worry, but in the future, if folks continue flocking there, then, you know, I think he's a lot of worries on his table, and this might be another one.
All right. While we're talking about worries, what about Twitter employees? You know, there's another story on the terminal. It talks about workers at Twitter's Singapore office told to empty out their desks, vacate the premises, according to those familiar, as Elon Musk continues to pare expenses around the globe. All right, so that's like go work from home, but you do wonder... Okay, do that, and then maybe what's the next step? But anyway, I'm just reading into this maybe incorrectly, but how do you see it?
Yeah, so this is kind of one of the moves that we're seeing happen under Musk where costs are being cut. Basically, the offices, the leases are expiring. They need to kind of figure out another plan. Twitter employees have had a lot of whiplash lately, and it seems like there's been kind of a month-long refocusing on things. So whether you're working from home and that's kind of changing your day-to-day, whether it's changing the feed like we've seen, whether it's trying to roll out new kind of valuable offerings to advertisers, a lot of which have left or paused spending on the platform, the Twitter employees that are left are not only doing their jobs, but also having to deal with a little bit of the chaos that we've seen over the last few months. So Singapore is one of the offices. We'll see if they continue to kind of shrink their footprint and shift to a kind of grand work from home model, which Elon has also said he is not interested in. So I think the read through is the chaos or the whiplash seems to kind of continue for folks both on the platform and those behind the scenes who are keeping the lights on.
Is it just me, Alex, or has Elon Musk kind of toned it down a bit on Twitter over the last couple of weeks?
He's been a little quieter. I don't know if that's the holidays or if that's the New Year rush or if they're annual planning, but it does seem like the drama has calmed down. But you remember, there's some big beats still to come, right? He said they're looking for a new CEO to take over a lot of the operations. He's got a big debt bill due in January. So I think we'll still have enough drama and fodder to talk about, even if he's not taking it to Twitter himself.
Listen, he told us, 14 hours ago, maybe we should spend less time on social media. I mean, come on, he's got other things to do.
I'm going
to
take
he's
that advice.
Down. Oh my God, it's going to be an interesting year. Alex Borinka, thank you as always. We're getting a double dose of Alex this week, and really good to check in with her. Twitter, yeah, we'll see.
We'll see. You going to try Mastodon?
No.
There's also Post News, which...
Say what?
Post News.
Are you on it?
I'm on that, but I haven't been...
Do you use it?
No, I haven't been. I got to get
this
back
is the
on
guy
it.
Who like deletes Twitter and then puts it back on?
Yeah, it's just I'm an addict.
No
it's
offense. Bad. I loved him, but I don't know that I'm going to follow.
Well, you follow me on Twitter.
I follow you on Twitter, but I don't know if I'm going to follow what you do here.
Thanks. Hey, thanks. Thanks, co-anchor Carol. It's nice.
Heart love, 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 love.
Okay.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we talked earlier about today's CPI report. The U.S. is making progress, it seems, on inflation. It has also made progress on COVID, and yet we also talk a lot about how we're not completely over the pandemic, how a new Omicron subvariant is out, and that cases are once again rising around the United States.
Back with us for an update on the virus and where we are in the U.S. and around the world, we've got Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar and infectious disease physician at the Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. It is, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. He joins us from Pittsburgh this afternoon. Dr. Adalja, it's good to talk with you again. It's been a while, which I guess is kind of good because, you know, it's not good when we were speaking with you every single week and the only thing we were talking about was COVID. But like you said, you know, over the last 2.5 years as we've been talking to you, this is a virus that's going to change. It's a virus that's here to stay. How are you looking at it being part of our lives right now?
I'm looking at it as something that we're going to continue to have to deal with, that people are going to have to continue to learn how to risk calculate with, and science and technology are going to continue to have to advance to give us new tools to be able to make it as manageable as possible. But I do think that it's going to be something that is always going to be generating new variants and headlines, but it's something that is now, much like other respiratory viruses, because of all of those tools that science and medicine have given us.
So, okay. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think, first of all, I can't believe we're, 2 years out here now, 3 years out. So much has happened, so much in terms of how we think about these things and understanding that on a health basis, you know, the unthinkable can hit a developed and many developed nations like the U.S. and others. So way forward here, I think about this a lot, 5 shots in. I mean, do I just have to keep getting shots?
Well, I think that if you're somebody that's of average risk, that you don't have any high-risk conditions, that you're not older, you don't have cardiovascular disease, you don't have obesity, you're not pregnant, immunocompromised, the actual regular vaccine, the standard dose, does hold up really well against what matters, serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And boosting is really important for people that have risk factors for severe disease. I don't think that for the average healthy person, boosters do much. They don't cause harm, but they're not really going to give you much protection against infection, because this virus has sort of evolved away from being able to be protected by our first generation vaccines. And I think it's really about protection against serious illness when it comes to vaccines and boosters. Maybe we'll get better vaccines that are more broad, that are not as susceptible to being kind of limited by variants. But right now with these first generation vaccines, it's really about protection against serious illness. And that's why I think boosters should be targeted to high-risk individuals.
Wow.
Exclusively.
That's really surprising to hear from you. I mean, I thought the general guidance was everybody who's eligible should be getting a booster.
I've always been sort of a booster skeptic. I thought that when you look at what the vaccine was doing, it was protection against serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And so you have to actually have a baseline risk of that for the boosters to give you benefit. And what we see is the boosters don't really do so much, especially in the age of Omicron, when it comes to protection against infection. What they really do is protect you against serious illness. So that's why I think it's really almost mandatory that if you're older and have or any high-risk condition, you should be boosted. And in fact, I think we have kind of this wrong situation in the United States where there are people who are at low risk who tend to be boosted to a very high degree, and then you look at the 300 to 400 people that die every day in the United States from COVID, and none of them are boosted. So I think that we diluted the message by pushing for universal boosting, and the people who actually needed to be boosted, who needed to hear that they should prioritize getting boosted, that really didn't reach them. And I think that's the problem. You know, we need nursing home residents to be boosted, not healthy 30-year-olds.
Is there a difference between the antibodies that are formed as a result of getting boosted versus the antibodies that are formed as a result of a prior infection?
Not really. They're in the same general category. There may be some tweaks depending upon which variant you are infected with, which booster you got, if you got the original booster or the bivalent booster, how strong they are. And there is some evidence that you're getting repeated boosters. You don't, even with the bivalent booster, you don't make different types of antibodies. You still continue to overwhelmingly make the antibody to the one virus that you first were exposed to, or the one type of spike protein you were first exposed to. That's something called imprinting, which is a little bit complicated. But in general, the bottom line with boosters is, yes, they're helpful, but it's really about protecting the high-risk populations with them, not necessarily the average risk person.
I think what's surprising to me is just the anecdotal, and it's so dangerous to use anecdotes when it comes to anything about medicine, because medicine is, when you get this stuff, it's approved, it's peer-reviewed, it follows the scientific method and so on. But it's like, okay, my mother-in-law comes and stays with us. It turns out she had COVID the whole time, and the three of us don't end up getting COVID. And I kind of attribute to that to, well, okay, we previously had COVID.
Right.
Or because we were recently vaccinated. I don't know, Dr. Adalja. It's like hard to explain this stuff that, you feel protected, but you don't necessarily feel protected.
Yeah, there's a lot of variables that really influence whether somebody gets infected. When was the person that you were exposed to? When were they contagious? What kind of immunity do you have? We know now that people who have hybrid immunity, a combination of being vaccinated plus natural infection, have the strongest type of immunity. How fresh was your last vaccine or booster or last infection? All of that plays a role in how likely somebody is to get infected. And there's a lot of variables that are at play. But this is a ubiquitous virus, and we're always going to be getting exposed to it. We're always going to know someone that has COVID. This is now part of kind of the infectious disease milieu that we all will face, all humans will face, for the foreseeable future on this planet.
All right. So if we are thinking about moving beyond this one, the coronavirus or COVID, is there another one that's likely to hit us probably in a few years or sooner? I mean, is that just kind of the fabric of our life now?
Well, not now. It's always been the fabric of our life. If you look at the history of the human species on this planet, it's been pandemic, epidemic, famine, infectious disease threat after infectious disease threat. It's only in the last 100 or so years where we've had somewhat of a respite because of sanitation, because of the development of vaccines, because of the development of antibiotics and modern medicine. But for our, if you talk to somebody, if you look at if you plot the whole human species time on this planet, almost just this little bit from around 1945.
Oh, I think we're having some problems with that cell phone talking. If you want to finish your thought in terms of, historically, you say this has always been a part of it, but it really, in modern times, it feels like it hasn't.
Right. I think only because we kind of had the luxury of vaccines and sanitation and antibiotics and antivirals. But if you look at the entire world, there were still tens of thousands of people dying from measles. In the United States, we have tens of thousands dying from influenza. I think that was kind of a false sense of security, just based on the fact that people weren't paying attention to what was going on in the infectious disease world. So it's hard to predict when the next pandemic will be, but it's always not a question of whether one will occur. It's when it occurs. It's not if. And there are other viruses, other respiratory viruses, flu viruses particularly are top of the list, including avian flu viruses that I think we have to continue to prepare for.
Yeah, I've heard also just the general flu or the seasonal flu this time around has been really rough on a lot of people. Dr. Amish Adalja, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Senior scholar and infectious disease physician at the Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported, as you know, by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies, joining us on the phone from Pittsburgh. I don't know about you. I mean, I'm going to probably still, if I can.
I was surprised to hear those comments about boosters that he made. Yeah. But he's right that, they need to get to the people who
really need it.
Yeah.
But I also am watching China because it's still a nation that's, fighting it.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, it is out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, always on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's the annual, the year ahead issue, the major trends, disruptions, breakthrough products, innovations, and movements to watch in the coming year. It complements this week's Bloomberg Live event in Davos that's happening as the World Economic Forum hosts its annual meeting there. And the cover story has to do with the economic outlook.
It's written by Stephanie Flanders. She's Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor for Economics and Government. She's here with us now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. It's a real treat to have her on this side of the pond because she's usually, of course, based in our London office. Stephanie, how are you?
I'm all right. Looking at the year ahead.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the year ahead because you write about these three pillars that kind of held together the global economy. It was helpful to have low rates, but it was also helpful to have a kind of a conflict-free world, you know, notwithstanding some minor conflicts here and there. And then also, of course, energy prices were kept low for quite a while. If we look back on 2022, those pillars all kind of crumbled.
Yes, and that's what I was thinking. So what's useful about doing this exercise for Business Week, and I have done it a few years now, is you sort of, obviously, you're quite caught up in, especially these days, on exactly what's going to happen to the economy this year, and are we going to get our heads around inflation? Is the Fed going to stop tightening? But you also want to step back and think, okay, how has the world fundamentally changed? And I think this was one of those years where I thought, wow, we really have had these fundamental assumptions underpinning maybe 30, 40 years of global economic history, certainly my lifetime of thinking about economics and thinking about the world, all having kind of been kicked away over the last couple of years. It's not just cheap energy prices. It's not just cheap labor costs and transportation costs. And as you said, the sort of friction-free period for geopolitics, at least when it came to, you know, am I going to find it fairly easy to set up a complicated supply chain in Asia or China? And all of that has gone away. And then on top of all that, you know, you kind of every time any one of those pillars was sort of shaky, you always had the Fed put, right? You always had the Fed there, super easy money, kind of free money to make everything still, make the numbers still add up. And when you start looking ahead and thinking, okay, if those have gone in quite a lasting way, decoupling, whatever you want to call it, as well as potentially kind of higher interest rates sticking around for a while, you know, that could mean something quite fundamental, not just for economic growth, but also for global politics.
You know, we talk about pivots, and I do think about Stephanie. Is it just a case of a reset, certainly here in the United States, but elsewhere, this whole idea of cheap money, no more?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, as you know, I'm normally in London, and the sheer pace of change there has been extraordinary. I mean,
right. People,
you know, the difference between getting a mortgage in July and getting it in September, partly thanks to the sort of craziness we had in Parliament, but actually not just that, you had rates double or treble in many cases. People are going to be going up in the next few months, renegotiating their mortgages, and going from a 1% rate to 6%. and they're going to fail their affordability tests. And, you know, so, yeah, we don't know how that's going to play out.
Well, how do you think about this? Like, this whole idea of the Fed still thinks they're going to get down to 2%, right, in terms of inflation. I mean, that's their target. There are many people say, no way. Things have changed dramatically. How do you think about that globally? Like, has something, is it different this time around? Is there kind of a new rate because of some global macro forces that have changed forever?
Yeah, I think so. There's, as you know, a big debate about this.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of economists on both sides, as always, so we can keep up the debate. Yeah. But I think... this year it's going to depend quite a lot on China. So you have the very rapid reopening actually may be unhelpful to the J-PALs of this world, because, as you know, we could then see maybe an extra 1 percentage point, maybe an extra 2 percentage points on global inflation just because of faster China growth and higher energy prices from that. But looking further ahead, has there been a more fundamental shift between the relationship between unemployment and wages? You know, we've had all these years where you had super low unemployment, you know, very tight labor market, but wages didn't budge. Now, you know, the dam is kind of broken, and you have got these much bigger wage rises coming down the track in many countries. If they get locked in, then you're right. You know, we're in a different world.
You write at the end of the piece that the microeconomic trend for 2023 is going to be nearshoring. The idea of untangling some of these supply chains that companies have spent a generation building, as they've gotten concerned about, okay, maybe COVID zero in China or trade relationships with countries, including China. How do you think that's going to continue to play out? Because at the same time, it does seem like labor is so... You know, you don't want to unravel too much. And a company like Apple, for example, is so inextricably bound to a country like China.
Well, I actually think that's one of the fundamental tensions, and that's actually why I've set up a whole squad. Now I've got control of the economics and government here at Bloomberg. We've got a geoeconomic squad,
yeah,
precisely because the economics and the politics is really kind of coming into tension at the moment. I don't think any of these big companies want a niche nearshore particularly. It wouldn't be their first choice. It wouldn't be their choice to come out of China. And they're resisting that in many areas. But they're also looking at the writing on the wall, that as the geopolitical trends that we talked about from the last 30 years have gone into reverse. You know, the politicians, in a sense, are no longer on the side of closer and closer integration and globalization. So I think businesses, for the first time in a long time, have to reckon with... You know, if you like, the kind of the current of history running against them, you know, whereas previously, you know, in most places, people wanted to make things easier for global business. That's not the case now. You've got President Biden, you've got politicians all around the world actively making their lives harder.
It feels kind of glum in a lot of ways. No. You're not alone.
Like, even the good news in China is bad news.
Right, exactly. Like, and there was a lot of individuals say maybe it's not so great in the first half, better in the second half, but I think there's a lot of debate over that too. Could things actually come in better? Could the U.S. fare better too than the rest of the world or a lot of the world?
Yeah, and actually I even say that there. I think there's a scenario which says the U.S. dodges recession or has a very shallow recession. Even in the Eurozone, it's looking like, I don't think my optimism extends to the UK, alas, but in the Eurozone, it's looking like it's going to be a very shallow recession, and quite a lot of the countries may even dodge a formal recession. If we get to the end of the year and central banks have also kind of have basically got control of inflation and that we are within sight of 2%, then, as I say at the end of the piece, everything does become a bit easier. You know, we may still have these structural trends, these question marks, but it's on a slower burn, and you're not talking about these relationships just kind of going up in smoke.
Stephanie, does it feel, since you've said you've done this a couple of times for Business Week, kind of setting what the economic outlook is for the year, how does it feel different from last year? Do you remember, like, does it feel more certain or still uncertain but different debates?
I think the fundamental sort of narratives are actually clearer. And okay, actually going back to that point of geoeconomics, I sort of feel like I know what the story is or what the different elements of the story are going forward. But of course, I never know what's going to happen. And that's what makes life so interesting.
Okay, 30 seconds just to end on Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I think it's been almost a full year at the end of February. And, you know, 30 seconds again, Stephanie. I mean, how does this play out in Europe?
I would say one positive. I mean, of course, it's a massively negative event for the continent to have a war on its shores. But the way that Europe has hung together, not just the governments, but the people, I think is a source of inspiration and potential optimism. We'll see whether they manage to carry that forward.
Well, it's a great setup for the year, which should turn out to be, it sounds like, another interesting one. Stephanie, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Stephanie Flanders, of course, she's Senior Executive Editor for Economics and Government here at Bloomberg News. This is the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's the year ahead issue. You can find it on newsstands. You can find it online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And, of course, always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
And shares of Disney, they're up again. They're now up about 14% this year. Last night, a flurry of headlines as the company squares off against activist investor Nelson Peltz, who nominated himself to the board. What happens, though, now is the responsibility of longtime CEO Bob Iger, who, as you all know, he retired. Then he came back to run the company late last year. So there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, we've got a great group of voices with us this afternoon. We've got Bloomberg News Entertainment Editor Chris Palmieri, who's on the phone from L.A. He's going to give us the news. And then we get some more analysis from Bloomberg Intelligence Technology and Media Analyst Geeta Ranganathan, who's with us via Zoom from our Bloomberg Intelligence headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. Chris, I want to start with you because I made this comment to Carol earlier today. Bob Iger, the return of the Bob, he has not wasted any time in undoing some of the changes that his predecessor and successor, I don't know if there's a word for predecessor and successor, Bob Chapek made, starting with some rules at the parks, some rules at corporate HQ, and then also squaring off with Peltz. Bring us the latest.
Right. Yeah. So right off the bat, he indicated he was going to do away with this sort of controversial distribution arm of Disney that sort of made decisions about where all the movies and TV shows go and sort of wrangled a lot of staff internally. He hasn't really come up with that new plan yet, but he's indicated that's on the way out the door this week. Also, as you noted, it changes to the parks. You know, under Chapek, was known for, you know, squeezing every dollar they could out of park guests. And now Iger is offering things like some free photo passes this year and other things to sort of win them back a bit. And now, going to war with Nelson Peltz, one of the most formidable corporate activists, been doing this for decades, taking on big companies, Procter & Gamble, Heinz, and Disney Board saying, no thanks, Nelson, we'd rather not have you on it. So a proxy war, shaping up over the next few weeks.
All right, Geeta, come on in on it. What's wrong with Disney?
Too many things, unfortunately, Carol. So this, this whole timing by Peltz seems to be very, very smart. Obviously, I think Disney is in a lot of turmoil right now. We had a dismal, earnings report when they reported in November. You know, we saw streaming losses kind of balloon to about $1.5 billion for just that quarter. And if you kind of look at Peltz's slide presentation, which he calls Restore the Magic, he says
he's even got a website, Geeta.
Yeah, he's got a website. He's got a website, yes. Restore the Magic is the name of that website. And he basically says that, streaming losses are huge. They are going to reach $15 billion by 2024, which we kind of agree with. So all of those things, and then of course you had that huge management upheaval with the ouster of Chapek, the reinstatement of Bob Iger. So obviously the timing is kind of very astute on the part of Peltz. But having said that, I mean, a lot of the critiques that he has leveled against Disney and the board and the management, I mean, these were all already on the radar. And Bob Iger, as Chris pointed out, is already working on these. So, yes, he's given all of these. He's given this laundry list of items to do, but he hasn't necessarily given us a plan.
Well, I guess that brings me to my next question for Chris, which is, when we think about a succession plan here or any sort of plan, Iger had 15 years to make his plan at Disney when he led it from 2005 to 2020, Chris, and then he handpicked Bob Chapek. So his next step is figuring out not only what to do in terms of strategy, but also who's going to take the helm.
Right. And, they made so proactively some announcements along that route. When they rehired Iger, they said, you've got 2 years and what one of your main missions is going to be, groom that replacement. As part of this week's news, they announced the retirement of their current chairman of the board, replacing her with Mark Palmer, Nike's former executive, and he is now heading a specific subset of the board that's going to be tasked with finding that replacement. I mean, this is certainly one of the things that, Iger is well respected in the industry. But there's no one, no corporate governance expert, no analyst who really believes that this succession plan worked very well. And so this is definitely a weak point from him and something you didn't expect Nelson Peltz to hammer away at.
You know, Chris, I'm listening to you and I think about, you know, years ago, right? And I did, you know, we did a deep dive into Disney and it was Tom Staggs and I can't remember, Rizzullo, right? The CFO, where they switched places and these are the two guys that were said to be, you know, kind of getting different perspectives of the company. And one of them was going to maybe possibly likely take over for Iger and then it didn't happen. So, you know, I mean, is Bob okay about handing over the mantle?
that depends who you ask. You know, there's certainly a school of thought that says he's not a guy, you know, and historically, by the way, Disney CEOs have had a hard time giving up the job.
Fair.
You remember Michael Eisner. So, you know, he stayed, renewed his contract four times, at least five now, if you count this one. You know, he is one who, you know, very much wanted to stay in that role.
Geeta, what's your thoughts in terms of Bob Iger back at the helm? Is this exactly what the company needs to kind of set it straight? And then ultimately, do you think he'll be comfortable in 2 years' time handing over the top spot?
Yeah, that's a loaded question, Carol. So, you know, I think he is absolutely the best person to lead the company right now. He knows what needs to be done. He's very, very familiar with all of the assets, all of the IP. You know, he clearly understands that some of the content, especially the animated content, has been underperforming. So there is a clear task on hand for Bob Iger. So I'm sure he knows exactly what he's doing. Now, the question comes to succession, and this has, you know, this has been botched by Iger. I mean, he's, for all the successes that he's had, I mean, this is one consistent area where he has failed. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see because he has, I mean, it really ultimately, I think, comes down to creative expertise. And this is something what all the other prior candidates, I think, have collectively lacked, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it was a Tom Staggs or whether it was a Jay Rizzullo and even Tom Chapek. I mean, he was a Parks guy. So, you know, it kind of, that whole creative process, managing talent, I mean, that is something that only very few people can do. And so it's going to be interesting to see if they can really find somebody within 2 years. My suspicion is, you know, this is again going to be a deja vu situation because, yes, he's invigorating the content right now. He's, rejiggering the whole creative process. But I don't think 2 years is going to be enough for him to really complete what he starts.
So if he's doing really well, Geeta, is it possible that he sticks around?
And should? So. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
He's got to update that autobiography that he released a couple of years ago, I think. Hey, Geeta, in terms of names, is there any chance that Disney would go outside of the company to find someone?
I definitely think that's possible. I mean, there are a few names that, you know, keep coming up internally. You know, obviously, Christine McCarthy, she's the CFO. She has a lot of experience. But again, if they're really looking for somebody with that creative kind of genius, I don't know if she necessarily fits the bill. Of course, you have Dana Walden, who comes from Fox, who probably, you know, does have a lot of creative expertise. She's, you know, kind of managed the TV and the entertainment business. But I wouldn't be surprised if they look outside as well. And again, here also, you know, a very interesting point by Peltz about why they would have chosen, you know, Bob Chapek and not Kevin Mayer. And that's something that we were all kind of scratching our...
And Mayer's long... Kevin Mayer's long gone at this point.
He is, yes. He's doing his own thing now. But, you know, that was a big shock, actually. A big surprise when that whole announcement came out. Just kind of given his... involvement in the whole streaming initiative, just kind of given his whole expertise with content. Yeah.
What about the, hey, Chris, what about the Marvel head? I mean, Kevin Feige, I mean, is that a possibility?
Yeah, I don't think so. You know, Kevin is without a doubt the most successful producer in the history of Hollywood. And so, you know, he's had plenty of opportunities if he wanted to rise within the organization or go to another studio. I think he's very content running Marvel, and you know, probably it would arguably doesn't have the broader experience it would take to run the Walt Disney Company.
Well, it's an incredible company. When we talk about, you know, a world where content matters, this is a company that has so much and is so good about kind of mixing it across the platform. So it will be interesting to see.
One that's reinvented itself many times over a century.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So we'll keep an eye on it. I know so will our team. Chris, thank you. Chris Palmieri, entertainment editor at Bloomberg News, on the phone from LA. And always, always our thanks to Geeta Ranganathan. She's technology and media analyst with our Bloomberg Intelligence team from our BI headquarters in Princeton.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 18 minutes left in the Thursday trading session, getting ready to wrap that up. Stocks, you just heard the numbers and the overall market numbers from Doug, but stocks coming off their highs of the session. So let's see what our next guest has to say about the outlook.
Very pleased to have with us this afternoon Chris Igoe, CIO at the asset manager AXA Investment Managers, with us via Zoom from London. Chris, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. So the CPI report here in the U.S. has come and gone, and it really just hit expectations. My feeling is that investors were kind of pricing in something even softer, Carol.
Yeah, I think so. Hopeful.
Yeah, they were hopeful about that. What do you make of it, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was the expectation it could have come in lower, but I think the trend is very encouraging. We had all the nasty surprises in the middle of last year, and the last few months, the numbers have come in line with what economists have forecast. So that's encouraging, and it suggests that inflation is going to gradually ease as we go through 2023.
Hey, Chris, one thing I do wonder, you know, bonds have definitely gotten more competitive when it comes to the equity side of things. If you look at, you know, what we're seeing in terms of yields versus what you yield on the S&P 500, how do you think about bond stock? Let's go basic. Bond stock allocations, how do they compare?
Well, I think bonds are back. I mean, we've got yields now which are attractive, and for many years they weren't. So I think investors who are managing or running multi-asset portfolios can really see a more interesting role for bonds this year. You're getting higher yield for the same amount of duration or credit risk. And at a time when the outlook for equities is still somewhat uncertain, because we're just about to head into earnings season, most of the forecasts are for a modest recession in the US this year, I think bonds give that certainty of return, which we haven't had for some time.
Having said that, you know, we just talked with our Stephanie Flanders. The year ahead issue of Bloomberg Business Week is out, and she really, you know, sets the tone in terms of talking about the global economic outlook for 2023 and how it too could hold some surprises. 2022, right? Who'd have thought we'd see a Russian invasion of Ukraine? Who'd have thought, going back to 2020, that we'd be in the midst of a global pandemic that shut down the economy? You know, wow. A reminder that things come out of nowhere. And I do wonder, how do you think about that in regards to this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think these things are always unforecastable, aren't they? But what I would say is that today, markets are cheaper than they were this time last year on the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. If we go back to bonds, you've got more yield providing a cushion to returns. And equities are still, you know, 10, 15, 20% off their highs. So I don't see as much downside, and I don't know what the big shock will be this year. But, you know, we've had the war, we've had the invasion, we've had 400 basis points of Fed tightening. Hopefully, we won't get those things again. So I'm hoping for a more boring year where you can get decent returns.
And boring and decent returns, that certainly would be nice, I think,
for
a lot of
new,
people.
Right?
The S&P 500 is at 39.77 right now. Earlier on our program, our colleague on TV, Romain Bostic, mentioned that it was close to its 200-day moving average. It's certainly an important technical level. To you, looking out across the at least this cycle, do you think we've seen the bottom in this cycle?
I tend to think we have, yeah. I think, you know, a lot of the derating last year was because yields were going up, and particularly real yields. They seem to have peaked now. We've had the uncertainty about how much the Fed will need to tighten. That seems to be clearing up a bit. We know there's going to be a growth slowdown. I think that the swing factor at the moment is the earnings numbers and how they're going to look over the next several quarters. But to me, it would take some really, really bad news for us to test last year's lows.
Mm. I want to go back to fixed income, because you say, Chris, that fixed income really stands to benefit most when inflation and interest rates peak. And it does feel like we're going to get to it, whether it's this year or maybe at least the thinking is that the Fed is coming near an end and maybe global central banks are as well. So what's the fixed income play? Is it sovereign debt? Is it corporate debt? What is it?
I think the sweet spot is investment grade credit. And actually, it's the short end of the curve. It's the short maturities, because the yield curve is inverted. So you're getting higher yields at the short end of the market than you are in the 5, 10, or 15-year sectors. So why take on that additional maturity risk when you can get nice yields today? So investment grade looks good. We're quite positive on the fundamentals for credit. And if you're feeling really optimistic, go into high yield, where you can get 6, 7, 8% yield without taking too much duration risk. And I think, given where we are in the cycle, that's a very attractive proposition.
Any you know, companies, sectors in particular, or any regions of the world when it comes to corporate?
Well, we like dollar debt. We like US dollar denominated debt.
Okay.
And that extends to things like emerging market hard currency debt as well. We're already seeing, I think, some signs where the fundamentals are improving. And we've already had quite a bit of issuance this year so far. Saudi Arabia came with a big deal. Israel came with a big deal. You know, US rates are peaking. The dollar seems to have peaked. These are all good signs for emerging markets.
What about Europe, closer to home? How does the year look? I mean, we spent a lot of last year talking about concerns that we could hit a recession. And Carol, you mentioned it, but Stephanie Flanders essentially saying that, you know, recession in Europe might be more shallow than many people thought. It's pretty interesting to hear this, Chris.
Although UK, she wasn't so sure about.
Exactly. Do you see opportunities there, Chris, as a result of the continued strength that we're seeing?
Well, you know, I think the big issue for Europe was the energy situation and the turning off of the Russian supplies of gas. And they seem to have dealt with it pretty well. We're having a relatively mild winter so far. So,
but how about those energy prices that you're paying for you are paying for heat?
They're coming down, and eventually they'll come down for the consumer as well. China reopening is actually pretty good for Europe as well, because a lot of the industrial goods will get a boost from when China starts to demand more imports again. And I see more opportunity on the equity side, really, than on the fixed income side in Europe, because equity markets here got smashed last year. They were trading on, you know, below 10 times this year's expected earnings. And if things aren't going to play out quite as badly as they as thought a few months ago, then there's certainly some significant upside for equities. It's more of a value cyclical play, but in contrast to the US market, which remains dominated by tech, I think Europe has got some upside on the equities side.
Well, Chris, really appreciate getting some time with you today. Chris Igo, he's Chief Investment Officer at AXA Investment Managers, joining us via Zoom from London on this Thursday.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.